The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. This holiday season, give yourself the gift of 5,000 years of wisdom. The first month of your Gaia membership is only 99 cents, so sign up today by going to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. Thanks, Gaia, and happy holidays.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy holidays. To my mind, it is the best time of the year and one that I enjoy thoroughly. And maybe you'll be able to tell by this week's special, because this may be the longest paranormal podcast in our 11-year history of doing podcasts. This is a Christmas mega special. We're going to start out talking about Krampus. I know people have been waiting for this one, and I think that you'll enjoy it. And then we're going to dive back into the archives and have Mary Beth Crane join us from 2009 to talk about Christmas ghosts. And then last but certainly not least, Rosemary Ellen Guiley from 2014 talking to us about Christmas angels. And I hope that this is the best holiday season you have ever. Or maybe I hope next year's even better, but that you've had so far, let's put it that way. And I thank you all so much for listening during 2016. Merry Christmas and happy holidays, and here's the Mega Paranormal Podcast Christmas Special. Yes, today the subject is Krampus. You know, we talk about Santa Claus and all the warm and fuzzies of the holiday season. Well, that's not what we're going to talk about today. Our guest is Al Ridenour. He is the author of the recent book, The Krampus, The Old Dark Christmas, Roots and Rebirth of the Folkloric Devil. And Al is an eminently qualified man to write a book like this. He's written for the LA Times, LA Weekly, Fortean Times, Maxim Stuff, and many other periodicals, as well as the websites Boing Boing, Laughing Squid, Atlas Obscura, and Morbid Anatomy. He's also author of Offbeat Food, Adventures in Omnivorous World, an exhaustive survey of culinary oddities and culture. And we are so glad to have him with us today. Al, welcome to the Paranormal Podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, for those not familiar, who exactly is Krampus?
The Krampus is basically Christmas tradition, because it actually is traditional to a bit earlier in December, but if we think about the American Santa Claus and his, he has a slight function still of determining, you know, whether kids are good or bad. The good ones are supposed to get better gifts than the bad ones. Well, this is the character in Austria and southern Germany who basically takes over with where we get to the bad kids. There we have, rather than Santa Claus, we have Saint Nicholas. It's a figure that our Santa Claus is loosely based on, but we're talking about Catholic regions, so this is the Catholic saint. And this character in costume, there's folk customs where this character is impersonated, and he'll go house to house in these alpine regions of Austria and Bavaria, and he's accompanied by the Krampus, who is basically there when the kids haven't been good, or in more realistically, he's there as the threat of what happens if you aren't good, because usually the Nicholas character finds that all the kids are pretty good. But he's there for this too, as sort of he plays the bad cop to the Nicholas's good cop, and like he offers that little scare that maybe helps the parents have better kids for the year, that little bit of motivation they need.
Now, when we think of Santa Claus, of course, it goes back to Thomas Nast and than the whole Coca-Cola advertising. We all say Santa Claus.
Thomas Nafty was German and was influenced by some of this tradition, actually.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I did not know that. And I guess what I'm getting at is that we have this picture in our mind of Santa Claus, what he looks like. If you walk up to a stranger on the street, what does Santa Claus look like? They can describe him. What does Krampus, what does Krampus look like?
Well, there's probably the image that is most universal was the image that circulated on postcards in the early 1900s. It was kind of a craze, kind of a seasonal postcard that people would send each other. It was actually this image of the Krampus was popular to send to like your girlfriend or your boyfriend. And I guess parents would send it to kids, uncles, to aunts, and so forth. So they had this iconic image, and it's usually a sort of dark, furry devil, horns, often a dangling, grotesque dangling tongue. And on his back, he usually has a basket with some screaming, horribly frightened children. And he has, maybe he has some chains around him, and he's carrying some switches. So that would be the sort of your basic postcard Krampus. Now there's also, that's one form, mm-hmm. but that's the other form would be the costume form for the folk customs where these characters, like I was mentioning earlier, go door to door. And it's really pretty different. These two traditions didn't overlap as much as people might think. So, and that costume tradition is very regional. So it's really there's a lot of different versions of the Krampus and characters that are also like him. And I put a lot of pictures in my book because I thought it was important for people to see some of that variety.
Now, a lot of characters like the Krampus, they have some basis in fact, like the germ of truth that's kind of been appropriated and exaggerated and so forth. Is there any evidence that the Krampus in some way was real historically?
Oh boy. my immediate answer is absolutely not, but now that's an interesting
question. I like when I throw somebody for a loop.
Well, I think there's a very solid reality that the Krampus is based in. But it's a psychological, it's sort of more of a psychological reality. It's the need for parents, the utility. We don't do it as much as they used to, but the need for parents to have a boogeyman. And that is the idea of a boogeyman, somebody that's mentioned to kids to keep them in line. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. So that's a pretty universal, that's a pretty universal phenomenon. You see that in all Western and Eastern cultures. I don't know. I could say maybe there's something in the collective unconscious that's there. But I don't know as far as some creature that was sighted or so forth. I wouldn't say I can't really name anything like that. But the whole mood of the winter season in all through Central Europe and also even in the UK, it was people were on edge during these times. It was life was a lot more fragile, and there was a whole body of mythology associated with dire things that could happen, and also miraculous good things. But this period between Christmas and Twelfth Night, which is or Three Kings Day, December 6th, January 6th, forgive me. That whole period was considered really akin to Halloween. It was a time when spirits were spirits would cross, the veil was thin, so to speak. And so you'd have all sorts of supernatural phenomena people talked about. And, that, depending on where you stand, come down on that, there are dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of stories about these sightings of these. They take different forms. Sometimes they're ghostly, sometimes they're demonic. The more the church got involved, these ghosts would be considered demonic. It's never a singular ghost during this period. It's a horde of ghosts or a company of ghosts, and that's kind of what makes it a distinctive concept. There's a lot, many names for it. They call it the Wild Hunt, the Wild Horde, the Furious Army. These are all some kind of curious terms because they're translated. But these hordes of, let's just say, supernatural beings that were cited, that are in the records that people say they saw. Some people think that the Krampus tradition is an emulation of that. You've heard of the Krampus run is where the people dress up in these costumes and run through the village wildly. So there's that kind of chaotic, wild, supernatural aspect that is shared by these apparitions that some people say was used as sort of a form of magic. If you believe these supernatural beings are watching in your village, and they see that these monstrous things are running through your village, they say, oh, well, that village is already taken care of. So that's one explanation of how these traditions got started.
What's one of the nastiest things that the Krampus is purported to have done to bad little kids who didn't mind their P's and Q's?
People like that question. We all know about the switches. That's kind of boring. In the stories, at least, it gets a lot worse. He would eat the children. He would drag them off to the woods to abandon them, throw them in frozen lakes, and, of course, take them down to hell. Oh, and tear them apart. those are in one account or another.
I see. If that would happen today, I would see, the ACLU and a troop of lawyers. I think whoever would use that would be guilty of psychological torture.
Storytelling was a little less constrained back then, I think, as was parenting.
Now, do you find that we're in a bit of a Krampus revival? It seems like people are looking for something different, and I don't know if it's still going on, but people were putting up all black Christmas trees, upside down Christmas trees, looking for something different to add to the holiday other than kind of the tried and true Santa Claus and so forth. Is Krampus, on a high right now?
Yes, absolutely. I would say so. not only in Europe. In Europe, it's been sort of the whole thing has been kind of a phenomenon. It's been growing since the late 80s, since the 90s, I'll say. And it was greatly fueled by the internet. But in the U.S., we're obviously don't have it as we don't have quite the tradition they have there. But it's really been exploding since the early to mid 2000s, I'd say. And there are actually dozens of cities that have their own Krampus runs, including L.A., which I for 3 years I've been involved in producing those and a bunch of other Krampus events. But there's Philadelphia, Portland, Dallas, Pittsburgh. There's many more than that, but those are some that come to mind. And there's also even in England, they just last year started doing Krampus runs there. So it's grown beyond Austria and Germany, and it's definitely clicked with the sort of thing you mentioned. I think where people don't want the mom and dad's Christmas, the Norman Rockwell Christmas, and yet we're in a culture where you can't avoid this is in your face, and so you need a reaction. And honestly, I think even the most rebellious person enjoys some form of tradition, something they look forward to every year. So these Krampus runs, serve that function. It's a festive, exciting thing that can be done, that you look forward to, and every year improve it or you have some twist on it. Like it's the new Halloween, I think, for a lot of people.
Well, Al Ridenour is our guest. The subject is the Krampus. We're going to talk more about him, and let's hope he doesn't come get us during the commercial break right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. Now, I've been talking to a friend of mine, the jolly old elf himself. And from the list I have here, and I'm looking at it, I can see you've all been very good this year. So good, in fact, that you might even find a new streaming device in your stocking or maybe a new smartphone or tablet. Now, that's exciting. Don't get too excited. But once you get that, the question is, what are you going to watch on your new smartphone, tablet, or streaming TV device? Of course, you have all of those great movie channels everyone knows about. The names are household names. I won't repeat them here. But what if you want the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained? Well, there is an answer, Virginia. And that answer is Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the topics we love. For example, in January, Gaia is starting off the new year with a bang with a bunch of new shows, but here's just a couple. George Norrie's Beyond Belief, his regular series on Gaia, will feature a program on learning to change the future, which is kind of a neat thing. The series Buzzsaw will tackle the fascinating Mandela Effect with Corey Good. And that's just scratching the surface of the latest programming coming to Gaia in January alone. So now you really can stream Gaia anywhere. You have all these great devices, an upgraded state-of-the-art website, apps, your phones, your tablets. It's fantastic. Regardless of the way you access it, you're going to explore life's biggest mysteries with hosts like David Wilcock, Regina Meredith, and again, of course, George Norrie. And I haven't even mentioned their fantastic area of yoga, which is a huge section on Gaia. I think you'll really enjoy it. It is a great time to join because the first month of your membership is only 99 cents, and you can cancel at any time. To mind the wisdom and be entertained and enlightened, just go to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to sign up for your first month. It's only 99 cents. Now, that's a real holiday gift if I've ever seen one. Check it out. 5,000 years of wisdom now streaming on Gaia. History like you've never seen it. That's Gaia. Thanks, Gaia, and happy holidays. Our guest is Al Ridenour. The book is The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, Roots and Rebirth of the Folkloric Devil. And we're talking about the Krampus himself. And I must say, if you haven't seen the cover of this book, look it up. I mean, you should buy the book, of course. But wow, I wouldn't want the Krampus to come after me. I think he would give me some nightmares.
Oh, I'm sure he'd do worse than that.
He'd take my microphone away and break it into a million pieces. Now,
something closer to that.
Anyhow, I'm looking at some of the chapters here. Now, I've got to ask you about this one you have in chapter 5. Frau Perchta, Witches and Ghosts. Now, what do witches and ghosts and whoever Frau Perchta is, what do they have to do with the Krampus?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about the phenomena of these companies of ghosts. So that's actually all related to this character, Frau Perchta. Frau Perchta is an embodiment of another pagan figure, or it's collective, a species of figures called Perchten, plural. So these Perchten, there are still, much like there's Krampus runs, there are Perchten runs with people in costumes that to Americans would look very much like a Krampus, and in fact do look very much, and it's not just us. Rather than December 6th, which is St. Nicholas Day, and they're associated with the Krampus, these are associated with Three Kings Day, with Epiphany, January 6th. So you get your Krampus stuff in December, and then a month later you have the Perchten. And as I was saying, that period from Christmas Eve to January 6th is considered very kind of a dangerous, portentous kind of season. And the Perchten were associated particularly with the end of it. And they're a little hard to describe. Because they're very ambivalent. Sometimes they're good forces, and sometimes they're evil. They're generally perceived more as being threatening. I mean, this being a very sort of dangerous time of the year with the winter and the scarcity, that seems sort of natural. And then they're also kind of associated with New Year's falls right in the middle of that, so you have that kind of turning, the sort of, there's the Roman god Janus. So you have this sort of two ways things can go. This is a kind of, they represent that kind of tipping point in the year. So these characters took many forms, but their embodiment, the first character we hear about in the written record, is just late Frau or Lady Perchta, who generally was perceived, because we have to remember these are all the church fathers writing about, they were the only ones writing, really. So she's perceived very negatively as an ogress or a witch. The reason we particularly associate the Krampus activities with her is the stories that were told about her are similar. And what it was said was that she would go door to door on the night before Three Kings Day, just like Nicholas said in the Crumps. And she was checking the behavior of the occupants of the house. She was particularly concerned with the women of the house and domestic order, the tasks that women would tend to do, and particularly concerned with spinning, which was, you know, what kept most of the women busy during the season. You had to have your spinning finished by the time she came. And you also were supposed to prepare special foods and leave those out for her as a sort of bribe or offering. Her or the spirits that came with her, she often was kind of described as leading the host of these kind of companies, ghosts we talked about. And if you didn't do that, she was even worse than the Krampus, or the descriptions of what she would do to you were a little more, even a little more detailed. And it was very specifically defined. You'll see this over and over in the accounts. But what was said to the young ladies spinning in the house, to warn them if they didn't get the spinning done, was that if they didn't finish their spinning, Frau Perste would cut them open, gut them, then replace all their guts with rocks or straw or snow or some just sort of debris, and then sew them up with her iron needle. So that was her thing. That was kind of her specialty.
Wow. Now, I thought a lump of coal was bad. Now, so when we talk about, and I'm going to use St. Nicholas / Santa Claus as kind of a comparison here, there's certain things that go along with Santa Claus. You know, he lives at the North Pole. He rides around in a sleigh. He has reindeer. I mean, what do we know about the Krampus, where he lives? How does he get around? Does he have any special magical powers? What do we know about him in that regard?
Where he lives is hell. He's a lesser demon. He's a lesser demon. He's spoken of throughout the year as a sort of threat. I just was talking to some Austrians this weekend, and they were talking about how Krampus season begins in October. Their parents begin warning the kids about him. But he's considered one of the demons of hell. He wears chains, sort of indicating that's his home. He's chained in hell, but he's used by the saint. How he gets around, I don't know. He's portrayed walk. He doesn't fly or anything, but he does have there's a curiosity associated with his walk and his feet. In a lot of folk tales, the devil will have one unusual foot. Usually it's like a hoof. One foot is a hoof, one is a human foot. And so the Krampus is also portrayed at that often. In fact, and then the Frau Perste character I mentioned earlier could have that, but more likely she has one giant foot. And some people think that's because she would she was associated with spinning, and the spinner would have this one lead foot that kept going on the treadle over and over. That's sort of a nice way to think about it, but there was also a character, another aspect for another name, but basically filling the same function, who was who would smash naughty people, naughty girls and children with that foot. So the foot was one of her weapons. So as far as how the Grandpa Krampus gets around, it's pretty much on foot, or foot and hoof, I should say.
Now, the church interacting with Krampus, now you said it was used by saints, so it's like he's a demon, but the church kind of, I guess, would like him in a way, because it's kind of like, again, the stick to the carrot of Santa Claus. I mean,
exactly.
Okay.
I mean, the church had a whole hell filled with the motivation. So to have just pluck one demon out of there and once a year was really not very much. It's the same theology. It works in the theology. He's a demon, but he should always be. I always emphasize to people that he's not free. He can't. The world you would feel safe from him because he's under the command of the saint, St. Nicholas. So there was that. As long as you were good, you were safe. I was mentioning how the chains are often shown in the postcards. And again, that's a symbol that he's under the saint's control. Now, when you go to, when I was in Austria watching these Krampus activities, you really see that the saint, when he speaks, I mean, when he tells the Krampuses to stop running around, jangling their bells and swinging their switches, they immediately all freeze and they drop to the ground and heel like dogs. It's actually really funny. So he's there very much under his command. So he'll have like a whistle that he blows to. So they're not free to wreak evil wherever they want. It has to be purposeful evil for punishment.
Now, are there parallels to the Krampus in other cultures that you're aware of?
Certainly in, the Krampus is southern Germany. In the north, you have the close parallels, they call these characters dark companions, meaning dark companions to a gift bringer, St. Nicholas, or whoever that gift bringer is. In the north, in some areas, it's called the Christ Child. But in northern Germany, they have a character called Knecht Ruprecht, which just means servant. He's a servant. He's not quite as threatening. He carries switches. He might be said to hit kids with switches, but usually he just gives them to the parents of the kids as a symbol. In Holland, there's a character called Black Peter, who's supposed to be a Moor who accompanies from Africa, who accompanies Nicholas. And he has a whip and he cracks at the scared children. In France, there are similar characters. Father Whip is the name of one character. And then there are sort of female versions like that, like Valperste, who I mentioned too. There on the border between France and Germany, there's a character who lives in a cave and comes out once a year to visit up children, but it's also can turn into a snake that lives underwater. But actually, and the most famous, I could say the best parallel in some ways is the Italian. There's an Italian witch who's associated with Epiphany and who's clearly, it seems that she's a better survival of the Valperste mythology. Her name is La Befana. It's just it's the corruption of the Greek word for Epiphany. And so she flies in a broomstick, leaves. She's not as threatening as she used to be. Things tend to get kind of modified, and some of the violence is taken out in the stories. But so she's a witch. She's more associated with giving gifts than frightening children. But her aspect is that of an ugly witch, and she is really. I mean, that's not even an obscure tradition for Italians. There's the whole like marketplace in the center of the Piazza Navona, I think. It's full of like little dolls with this Befana. And in Venice, there's a regatta that's all people dressed as this witch. So you see these kinds of characters all throughout Europe, I'd say.
Now, I always like to ask authors this. I mean, obviously you went into this with one viewpoint. Maybe you knew a good bit about the Krampus, maybe not that much. What surprised you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think what surprised me is what surprises a lot of people in that I think people look at the Krampus character and they see the horns and they think Pan and they think, ancient classical mythology. And I think a lot of people assume that the Krampus is indeed that ancient, that it somehow is related to Pan. And, you know, there may be some tiny thread that you might trace that direction. The tradition is not as old as I was first given to believe. It's only the Krampus as we recognize it in terms of those costumes or those postcards, you know, only goes back to beginning of the late 19th, early 20th century. But again, we've been talking about all these other things that kind of fed into it, in all these roots that the tradition has, and some of them, like we were talking about Valperste, where she's mentioned by church fathers in the 1100s, but just the Krampus himself, as we recognize it, is not really that old. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for groups liking to, people want to find ancient roots. They want to feel connected to something really primal and old. And the connection is just a little more tenuous, but even the Krampus groups in Germany, sometimes Austria, you'll see on their website how it's a Neolithic tradition, which is not true. But it has, I would say, you know, the roots are deep, but they're more wide than deep. There's so many things that feed into it. And that's why my book is not really just about the Krampus. The first three chapters are, but then we talk about lots of other traditions and figures that we've been talking about tonight.
So if I'm a child, what do I exactly need to do to steer absolutely clear of the Krampus?
I think that depends on your parents. The old days would be say, the old days would be say your prayers, memorize your catechism, go to church, be quiet in church, be quiet in school, don't be too loud, don't all the things that current 19th century parents would tell their kids. But there's aside from pleasing your parent, what your parent's moral code is, there's really nothing else you can do to keep him at bay.
You know, my kids are, one's going to go off to college next fall, and the other one's about ready to go into high school. Boy, I wish I would have had this 10 years ago, Al. What I could have done with this. Oh, anyway. But now, you close out the book here with the chapter, Why the Krampus Must Come. Now, I know we've covered a lot of that, but why must the Krampus come?
Well, I was in Munich and at a Krampus parade. And I had this one moment where I kind of realized how it all works so well. There are all these Krampuses and crazy, you know, they're very frightening, realistic costumes who are marching down the street, and the crowds gather on either side of the street. And I saw this little boy who was he was visibly nervous. I think they could see him shaking. I was standing fairly near him.
Oh my goodness.
And he was kind of wanting to get away, but his parents were standing behind him with their hands on his back and just like, it's going to be okay. Come on, you can stay here. You'll be glad you did it. And indeed, the Krampuses came up and the guys in the suits are, you know, they want to be scary, but they don't want to mess the kids up.
Right.
So they're sensitive to, they're always looking around and seeing how they're affecting people. So this Krampus got low, like you get with a dog, you don't want to scare. And he put out his hand, and the kid, you know, took his hand and shook it. And then the Krampus, you know, shook his hand, and he left. And the kid was so proud of himself. Everybody around, I saw, look at all the faces around, everybody was smiling. Everybody was proud of the kid. And I feel like, you know, we have, kids don't have some of these kinds of challenges. We live in an environment where it's very much about making kids safe, and so they don't have this opportunity to, you know, overcome a fear. And obviously, you have to modify what kind of fear you present.
Right.
The Krampus,
sure.
It's actually a tradition. It's a little bit of home theater that the parents put together. The uncles, the aunts, the friends of the family. They're all like working for weeks before. Getting the costumes, don't tell the kid, and then reporting to St. Nicholas how he's been and writing that all secretly in this book Nicholas carries. So it's actually this child-centric thing that's very dramatic. And we had in L.A., we put on a Krampus play, which is actually something I translated from an old Austrian script from the 1900s. And so we have American kids that are basically playing the role of the Austrian kids, and the Krampuses come in, and they actually, in the plays, they actually speak. But, you know, the costumes are very scary. There's lighting, there's rumbling effects and stuff. And the kids were, the little girl this year who played, she just hunched over and was kind of, it looked like she was shaking. And then when the play was over, she was like completely wide-eyed, running around telling everybody how scared she was with the greatest smile on her face.
Oh.
So, I mean, I always like to be scared in a certain safe context.
Right.
You know, she knew it was make-believe, but, you know, it's fun to be scared. And then she was proud she did it. So I think it's, I think the Krampus is good for that reason, because we've kind of eliminated some of these challenges. And I think everybody around it has fun too. It's, you know, it's basically a form of folk theater, you know, home theater. So, you know, families are cooperating in this big production, which is, you know, brings the kids joy, but also brings the teenage boys and the 20 somethings have fun. They get a little drunk, they run around, they can smack their girlfriends with switches too. So I think there's a lot there to latch on to.
I think that's a really interesting way of looking. I would never thought of it that way, but that kind of positive message that it has for children, and kind of in a safe way, let them stand up for themselves a little bit and shake that hand. That's really an interesting way of looking at it. A great way to wrap up our discussion on the Krampus. But we must know now, as we release this, it's Tuesday, December 20th. There's a few days left till the big day. So where can people get this book on the Krampus?
The book is available on Amazon. It's available as an ebook as well as, you know, a print book. A lot of people seem to like the print book just because it's very, very photo rich. I think there's photos on every other page or so, maybe 100 plus photos. But yeah, Amazon, or any, you know, in any bookstore, any larger bookstore, any of the chains.
Now, I know the time for this year has passed, but people who live in the L.A. area from whence you come, there's some interesting activities around this time of year. They can bookmark it for 2017. Where can they go?
It's KrapusLosAngeles.com. And yeah, there's as many as a dozen events that start in late November. And also, if people are interested in contacting me, any email sent through that website will go to me.
Well, it looks like a great book, and I really appreciate your time tonight. Actually, I have a confession. I was very bad tonight, folks. I had miscalculated the time and was very late. Al was very gracious, so he doesn't have to worry about the Krampus. But I think I may have to worry about the Krampus because I was very late. But Al is a very gracious man and a great author and a great guest. Al, thank you for joining us tonight. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The book is The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas, Roots and Rebirth of the Folkloric Devil. Check it out. Next up, Mary Beth Crane and Christmas Ghosts. We have the perfect guest for Christmas time. I'm talking about Mary Beth Crane. She is the author of the new book, Haunted Christmas, Yuletide Ghosts and Other Spooky Holiday Happenings. Mary Beth was on our show last year, you might remember, in 2008, where we talked about haunted battlefields. And we had a great time then. And when I found out this book came out, I said, you know, we have got to get Mary Beth on the show to talk about this around Christmas time. Mary Beth is an established journalist, editor, and author. Her most recent book, as I mentioned, for Globe Piquois was Haunted U.S. Battlefields, Ghosts, Hauntings, and Eerie Events from America's Fields of Honor. Other books include the L.A. Times bestseller A Widow, A Chihuahua, and Harry Truman, and Guardian Angels. She's also co-authored with Terry Lynn Taylor the best-selling Angel Wisdom, and other books that she's done with Terry Lynn and published by Harper San Francisco include The Optimistic's Handbook and Angel Courage. And she's been prolific. She is an avid fan of the paranormal with a few ghost stories of her own to tell. And she's currently working on a novel with a supernatural twist. Mary Beth, thanks for coming back on the show. Merry Christmas to you.
Well, Merry Christmas, Jim. It's a pleasure.
Now, I want to start this out with a very personal story. You kind of start the book out and talk about the experience that happened with your late husband. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a very poignant way to start the book, and I think it'd be a great way to start the show. Tell us what happened.
Oh, okay. Well, my husband passed away of cancer in August of 1996, and we had been married not quite 3 years, mm-hmm. and he was just absolutely the love of my life. It was second marriage for both of us. He was a widower, and he was much older. He was 23 years older than I was, but we were absolute soulmates. And anyway, at Christmas time, 5 months after his death, I just didn't know how I was going to get through Christmas, basically.
Sure.
And so I just decided to go down to the pet store, the local pet store. He loved to go to the pet store because we love to look at kittens because we have a lot of cats.
Mm-hmm.
And he would like to go, and he called it getting a kitten fix. And, you know, he'd say, let's go down to the pet store and get a six-pack of kittens. And so we never did, but we always liked to look at them. And anyway, I thought, you know, I'm just going to go and kind of cheer myself up. And I went to the pet store, and there were no kittens. They were all gone for Christmas, but there was a little Chihuahua puppy who was 3 months old, and mm-hmm. I just fell in love on the spot. I took one look at this little dog, and I'd never owned a dog, and Adam didn't like dogs. Adam put dogs into two categories, woofers and tweeters, and he considered Chihuahuas to be tweeters and ankle biters. And I had mentioned to him at one time that I thought a Chihuahua might be cute because it might get along with our cats and whatever. But anyway, there's this little Chihuahua. And, you know, they let me hold him, and I fell in love, and he licked me, and then I thought, this is ridiculous. I'm going to sell the house. I'm going to move back to Los Angeles. It just doesn't make any sense. So I left, and a couple weeks went by, and it was Christmas Eve or the night before Christmas Eve, and I was really depressed. It was raining. This was in California, by the way, so there was not snow, but it was really raining, and a gloomy night, and I knew I needed to go to Barnes & Noble, which was 12 miles away, to get my brother a book that he wanted for Christmas. Right. And I thought, well, I am just going to go to Barnes & Noble. I'm going to get this book. I'm going to get out of there, and I'm going to come home. So I went there, got the book, and I'm on my way to the cash register, and it just felt like there was a hand on my shoulder. And I heard an inner voice say, go to the grieving section. And, you know, they always have a big section with books on loss and grief. Sure. And I was very familiar with that section. I think I'd only been there a couple weeks before. And so I was kind of arguing with myself, and I said to myself, why should I go there? I was just there. You know, there's not going to be any new books. But it was just this persistent feeling of something pushing me there. So I went to that section, and there was a young woman sitting on the floor reading a book. And she looked up at me, and she looked like a little angel. You know, she was very young, and mm-hmm. she had long hair and blue eyes. And she said to me, have you lost someone recently? And I said, yes, my husband. And she said, oh, I'm sorry. I lost my father. I said, oh, I'm sorry. And then she sat there, and then she said, I think I'm getting a message from your husband. Did he look like this? And she described him to a T. And I stood there, you know, talking about goosebumps. I said, yeah, that sounds like Adam. And she said, well, he's telling you that he wants you to take your medication. It's very important that you take it because you have a lot of work left to do. Mm-hmm. And I had been forgetting to take my blood pressure medication. I just could not remember to take it. I mean, I was really depressed, you know. And
sure.
Probably was an unconscious
very natural,
way.
Very natural.
Yeah, you know. And so she says this to me, and I'm just standing there like, what is going on? And then she said, I'm psychic, you know. And I thought, well, you and everyone else in LA, but yeah, And she said, and I never charge for my readings because God told me not to. She was really cute. Aww. And she turned out she was like 20-something years old. She asked me when I asked her when her birthday was, and she said January 26th, and that was my birthday too. So it was really strange. But anyway, she said, oh, your husband he wants to show me your house. My husband was very proud of our house.
Right.
And it was his home, you know, with his family. And I had just put that house on the market to sell it because I needed to move back to Los Angeles that's where my career was. And I had moved away to be with him. And I felt very guilty about putting the house on the market. The for sale sign had just gone up the day before. And she said, oh, your husband's showing me your house. It's kind of pink. And I'd had it painted a sandy pink. It was an adobe home, you know, and a stucco home. She said, oh, it's kind of pink, and there's lots of flowers, and I see a yellow sign in the front yard. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I just put the house up for sale. And she said, your husband wants you to know it's okay to sell the house.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's, you know, I started to cry at that point because I had asked Adam to forgive me for selling the house, you know.
Oh,
and
my.
Then she said, oh, he wants to take me on a tour of the house. And she described everything in my house. Now, I had never met this woman. I didn't know her from Adam, you know, literally, pun intended. Never met her before. And then she said to me, she said, your husband's very happy. He's surrounded by flowers, and he's always with you. And she asked if I had a big white car, and I had bought a white Windstar. And Adam used to love that car. And I bought it before he died, you know, because we needed a wheelchair, room for a wheelchair and his oxygen tank and everything. And she said, oh, he's telling me he loves that car. He's with you when you're driving. Well, you know, here it is, Christmas Eve. And she said to me, do you have a little dog? And I said, no. She said, but you're thinking of getting one, right? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, your husband wants you to get the dog. Well, to make a long story short, we talked for about 2 hours. We went over to the little, you know, cafe in the store.
In the store cafe.
And her her friend was there. She introduced me to her friend, and her friend said, "Yeah, I was driving, Andrea." And Andrea said, "Let's stop here." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "I don't know. I just think I have to."
Wow.
So she was never even planning to go to the bookstore that night.
So it was absolute synchronicity.
Yeah. And to me, it was a great example of, you know, Adam working the controls on the other side to get us together. Because what happened was I bought this dog. I went back on New Year's Eve. The dog was still there. And I bought him, and I named him Truman after Harry Truman, my favorite president, this little 3-pound chihuahua. And about 5 months later, I started writing a book about him. And Adam had always said to me, I had done a lot of co-authored books, but I had never done a book with my own name on them at that point. This was, I met him in 92.
Right.
And he used to say to me, he said, "I'm waiting for the day when I see a book with just your name on it." And he had a dream once that he saw a book with my name only, and it was in the window of a bookstore and whatever. So anyway, I started writing about this dog, and it turned into, you know, we sold the book, my agent and I, to HarperCollins in the summer of 1999. And it was called A Widow, A Chihuahua, and Harry Truman. And it was, mm-hmm. you know, a very funny and touching book about coming through widowhood and thanks to this dog. And Harry Truman and all of his wisdom. And so when I got the book, I got the advanced copy of it, and I was holding it in my hand, and suddenly it hit me. Oh my God, this is the first book I have with my name on it, nobody else's, and I could never have written this book if Adam hadn't died. I wouldn't have written a book about a widow, a chihuahua, and I wouldn't have gotten a chihuahua. And so it was when she said, "Your husband wants you to get that dog," I have no doubt whatsoever that he knew that this was going to be the book that
Amazing.
He wanted to see.
Amazing.
And yeah. So
and the thing that had happened during the holiday season, I would think, I mean, of course, this is very touching and significant mm-hmm. whenever it happens, mm-hmm. but it adds a little extra something to it, the fact that it was almost a Christmas gift, I guess.
Well, that's exactly it, you know, because this was, as far as I remember, it was either Christmas Eve or the night before Christmas Eve that this happened. And mm-hmm. it gave me such peace at the holidays. I think that's what he wanted, because I was so, you know, so upset at this time of year. And to have had that encounter with this girl, it just left me with such a sense of peace and the knowledge that he was with me. And that's what helped to get me through the holidays, really.
Now, when you talk about haunted Christmas, I mean, we generally don't think of Christmas as being, quote, haunted. But it is interesting. I love this because I'm a big Christmas carol freak. I love Christmas music,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially the old classics,
mm-hmm.
You know, Bing Crosby, Nat King Cole, and so forth. And there's one that all of us have heard, whether it's in commercials or on the radio or whatever. Andy Williams, "It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year." I have probably mm-hmm. heard this song thousands of times,
mm-hmm.
but I never caught this. It never registered with me. Although I do what I do, and I do a paranormal podcast, there's a couple of lines you quote here.
Mm-hmm.
"There'll be parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling out in the snow." But this I never really got. "There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago." And I thought that was fascinating because it's like,
mm-hmm.
well, they're talking about ghost stories in Christmas. What's up with that? And you kind of go into, there's a whole connection between Christmas and the other world that we've kind of lost along the years. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I found that very interesting, too, because like you, I'd kind of missed that line. And I think most people do. You know, they don't. And when you stopped, I actually looked at the lyrics of that song and thought, what? Ghost stories at Christmas?
Right.
But during the Halloween was really not invented, if you could call it that, until the 18th century. And Christmas, Yuletide, was really the equivalent of Halloween. Like many of the practices we associate with Halloween originated in ancient times and in the Middle Ages. And I said in the book that trick-or-treating had its roots at Christmas time in the Middle Ages, when after church people celebrated the holiday by getting drunk and disorderly, there'd be someone called the Lord of Misrule. It would be a student or a beggar or someone low down on the pole. And then the crowd of the subjects, it would be like, you know, a jester, really. They'd be very raucous, they'd be disorderly and drunk, and they'd bang on the doors of the rich, you know, and they demand food and drinks. And if they were not offered hospitality, tricks would be played. So, you know, it was give us our treat or you're going to get tricks played on you.
This actually sounds like a Christmas office party.
It does. It really does. So that's where, you know, trick-or-treating had its origins there. And then I talked about back in pagan days, winter solstice was the official end of darkness, and it marked the return of the sun, you know. And so December 25th, way before the birth of Christ, it marked Yuletide in Northern Europe, and then Saturnalia, which was called the Feast of the Unconquered Sun in Southern Europe. And in the South, everybody went crazy. You know, I said in the book that it was a time for unbridled revelry. And there were processions, there were feasts, there was cross-dressing. Men and women got rowdy. Kids could really be bad. They had their own feast juvenilia. And then up in the North, Yuletide was, well, it was colder up there. So Yuletide wasn't as much fun. And they really, the Northern Europeans really believed that at this time of year, this was right before the coming of the light, was when the forces of darkness would come out to do their mischief, and ghosts and demons were liberated during that time. It was known as Samhain. It was the 2 weeks before Christmas. So when early Christianity celebrated Easter, they celebrated the resurrection, but they didn't celebrate the birthday of Jesus until around the 4th century. The church, you know, wanted to get the masses more involved. So they made December 25th, which was really, you know, the solstice date, the birth of Jesus. We all know now that historians calculate that Jesus probably was born in April, but this was kind of a manufactured date. So anyway, it's what's really interesting is that I have some Baptist friends, and out here, I don't happen to be anything. I mean, I was born and raised Jewish. I'm kind of an everything, nothing. You know, when it comes to religion, I sort of embrace practically all religions. But mm-hmm. I have some Baptist friends, and they asked me what my newest book was going to be last year, and I said I was doing a book called Haunted Christmas, and they were just very appalled. Oh, that sounds satanic. Oh, hauntings of Christmas. You know, and it was just pure ignorance because they didn't know their history. That actually, and so I found the most interesting stories that, you know, in the Celtic calendar, December, this was the month of Samhain, and it was the most haunted time of the year, really. And that's when ghosts and spirits were said to start work. They started work on December 6th. They continued through December 20th. And then as the sun's powers began to regenerate, things really got heated up, literally. And malevolent or benign entities would come out of the woodwork. And you find stories about all of these demons, ghosts, and spirits everywhere in Scandinavia, Germany, Scotland, you know, Ireland, England, everywhere. And there was, one of my favorites was Frau Berchta, who, Frau Berchta was from Germany, and she was an old witch who was said to go through the countryside at that Christmas time, and she would either give gifts to the good, or, you know, to the nice, or she would punish the naughty. And then she had a male equivalent called the Belschnickel, which I think that tradition still continues in German households. Today, the Belschnickel was an elf, and he came at Christmas to either give gifts to good children or coal and switches to bad children. I mean, this is where the Santa Claus thing comes from, you know. Even though St. Nicholas was a real saint, mm-hmm. these traditions all seem to merge, you know. And at Christmas time, someone in a German household will very often be dressed as the Belschnickel, like we dress someone in, you know, someone will dress as Santa and come with a big sack of gifts and whatever. And there were trolls who would come out at the Christmas season in Greece. And, you know, they were said to cavort at midnight mass, and you weren't supposed to go out or you'd be kidnapped. And it just, you know, I found some really interesting fascinating stories about this.
Now, it's interesting to me, and you kind of touched on this, you know, to this day, many of the traditions that we follow every Christmas, I mean, we think of mm-hmm. Christmas as a Christian holiday, and it certainly is in many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, Christmas being the birth of Christ, but the thing is that many of the things we practice now are actually more holdovers from those pagan traditions.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And how they've made their way into, for instance, that thing about scary ghost stories that's in that song. And we all know A Christmas Carol, you know, Dickens' wonderful Christmas yes. Carol, where Scrooge is visited by three ghosts. And I think many of us think that Dickens got this out of thin air, but he was merely continuing a long-standing tradition in England of telling ghost stories at Christmas. And even today, the BBC still has the Christmas ghost story that everyone looks forward to. You know,
now, it's funny, actually, if I'm remembering correctly, I was looking at Audible.com as one of our sponsors, and I was looking for something to feature, and I believe that they have some of those recorded ghost stories
mm-hmm.
That you can actually purchase. So, folks, you know,
about
checking Audible.com for that. But yeah, that's very mm-hmm. popular in England. And Christmas is such a mystical holiday. It's fascinating. I want to get, after the break, more into some of the specific stories that you found.
Sure.
And we'll talk about those right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. As I was putting together this podcast, we came to this part because this had been aired multiple years where there was a commercial, insert commercial here. And I don't have an extra commercial to insert here. So I thought, well, what am I going to put there? And I think the best use of this space, even better than a commercial, is a big thank you. This morning, I was looking at my downloads historically over time. Maddie, my fine assistant, was asking me, well, what's the updated number that we tell people when we book them for interviews? And I did a tabulation, and it turns out that we're about at 25.4 million downloads, which absolutely blows my mind for the podcast we've done through 2005. And I just wanted to say a big thank you for listening for all of these years, whether you've listened on the free side or if you've gone all in and been a Plus member, maybe you bought a book or frequent one of our sponsors who really make the free shows possible, whatever. Or maybe you've told a friend, or maybe you've simply listened. I just wanted to say a thank you to you for that, whatever you've done. And just wishing you the best holiday season ever. That's all. Now back to the show. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our ghost tonight, our ghost. Our guest tonight. I've never done that in 5 years. Our guest tonight, I don't think she's a ghost, Mary Beth Crane. She is the author.
I'm a ghost writer. That's what I am.
She is the author of Haunted Christmas, Yuletide Ghosts, and Other Spooky Holiday Happenings. Now, there's about 30 different tales here of ghosts and goblins and there's a few different things that caught my eye here. So I'm just going to maybe pick out a couple of at random that caught my eye and kind of get your feedback on them.
Okay.
What about the, you know, on this show, we talk a lot about UFOs and lights mm-hmm. in the sky and things. And you talk in Chapter 8 about the ghost lights of Christmas. What are the ghost lights of Christmas?
Well, these are lights that are seen in different areas of the world, and they can be seen as kind of orbs, you know, orbs in the sky. They've been seen as shooting lights. And the ones that I talk about, what I said in my the opening here is that ghost lights are a phenomenon as old as civilization itself, variously taking the form of points of light, spheres or orbs, flaming comet-like illuminations, and even glowing beings ghost lights can be distinguished from lightning balls or UFOs because of their supernatural qualities. And there was a famous story that took place in Wales in 1904 in the little village of Egrin that has been documented. It was documented in newspapers of the day. Reporters came from all over to interview the woman that the ghost lights seemed to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, you know, I forget if they actually photographed them, but there were articles from the period where the photographers and the reporters actually saw the lights. And that story was, it involved a woman named Mary Jones, and it was around Christmas in 1904. She was a Welsh housewife, and she supposedly had a vision of Jesus, and then this vision was accompanied by these wild and brilliant lights all around. And when I was reading this, I immediately thought of the case of Hildegard von Bingen, the famous, very famous and talented nun of the 12th century, 18th century, something like that. But Hildegard made these fantastic drawings and paintings, and it kind of looked like Van Gogh, you know, his Starry Night, for instance. They were really weird, and they were, of course, religious-themed. And Hildegard claimed to have had these visions of holy lights all the time, or particularly when she got, she said she could feel Jesus' crown of thorns, you know, around her head. And then she'd see these great, wonderful lights, and they were all colors and auras and stuff like that. And later, you know, hundreds of years later, researchers determined that Hildegard suffered from cluster migraines, and that the crown of thorns was actually these migraines. And, you know, when you get migraines, you can see lights and auras.
Sure.
So anyway, I immediately thought of that. But Mary Jones was not afflicted with migraines. And other people around her saw these lights, too. And it was Christmas Eve, 1904, and there were three people in her little village in Wales, and they reported seeing a large light. I have a quote here, about halfway from the earth to the sky on the south side of Capel Chapel, Egrin, and some little lights scattered around it in many colors. And then for the remaining 12 days of Christmas up until Epiphany, these lights were visible to practically everybody. And there were many, many reports of seeing, in particular, three lamps about 3 yards apart, very brilliant and dazzling, and these were brilliant red and white lights. Mm-hmm. That fused into one big glaring flame, and it shot up into the heavens like a Roman candle. And anyway, what happened was Mary Jones had this vision of Jesus and saw these lights and decided she would start this Christian revival. And she became kind of like Amy McPherson. What was her? Was that her name?
Yeah, I believe so.
Sister Amy,
I know who you're talking about, yeah.
She was this wildly popular revivalist, and one of the most popular things about her was that these strange lights would travel with her, and they accompanied her. They'd float above her as she was walking to and from church, and while she was conducting her revivals, I thought this was so cute. The lights would just stay up above the church and wait for her, you know, like children or something, waiting, or dogs waiting outside until their master would come out. The strangest thing about these lights were that they were visible to some people and not others. There was a reporter who came to see her in 1905, and I believe he was with something called the Barmouth Advertiser. And he was walking with her and some other people, and he saw these three brilliant rays of light, and they were just amazing, and there wasn't a living soul there, or a house from which it could have come. This is what he wrote in his article. But only he and Mary Jones saw the lights, and the other three did not. And anyway, these lights, I forget how long they stayed there. There were other people who saw them. I guess it was just up until Epiphany. I guess they did hang around for a few months later. They're not there anymore, but these kinds of lights have been seen everywhere. There are some famous lights in the mountains of the Carolina Mountains that have been seen for 800 years. And the Indians say that they are the lights, the souls of slain warriors. Early America, there were, and also in Scotland, there was something called the corpse lights. And this would be a light that appeared in a room that would usually signal that death was approaching for someone. Or these lights could also appear when someone died or where they died. So it seems to be a cross-cultural phenomenon. And, you know, they are not ever explained scientifically. They definitely are not UFOs. And there hasn't been any other rational explanation for them. But I thought this was a really wonderful Christmas story, you know, because we think about the Star of Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. That was always in the sky guiding the wise men. And this was almost like a version of that in a way, especially these lights that would hover above this church. So,
and another thing you talk about, which kind of you wouldn't think of it, you talked about the people not associating Christmas with being haunted. Haunted Christmas trees. What's going on with that? A whole new meaning to O Tannenbaum.
Oh, my God. I found so many stories about trees. Trees that would move by themselves, ornaments that would move by themselves, and, you know, in all sorts of different places. There were a number of different of these trees in different hotels. And I'm thinking of one in particular. It was a story about a tree, and this one particular ornament would move. And it was the favorite ornament of the family cat that had died. And the owner, you know, the cat's owner said that she finally decided that the cat was there and was playing with the ornament, as it usually did. And
well, it's interesting because, you know, really that time of the year, and I don't know what other folks' experiences are out there. And, you know, obviously there's a portion of our audience who, you know, obviously do not celebrate Christmas, but for those of us who do, the bringing out of the tree for us, our family, is very almost ritualistic, and it's putting on the ornaments and the whole family does it. And invariably the conversation comes to, well, that was, you know, this relative's ornament and they're no longer with us. This our friend purchased this for us. They're no longer with us. So there's almost like, I don't know, I hate to say this, but there's some parallels to a wake or a funeral. If you go to one where you talk about stories of people that have passed on, and it's almost like a yearly ritual that those discussions take place. So I guess if you think about it, which we really don't, it would be very rich for some kind of manifestation of some sort.
Well, I believe that there's a lot of psychic energy around the Christmas tree and around things like these ornaments. And one of the things I talked about was that, you know, since pagan times, the Christmas tree itself probably, you know, has its origins in pagan times when the tree was a symbol of eternal life. And so pagans worship living trees, and they didn't, you know, cut them down and put them in their homes, but they did decorate live trees with little bits of metal and candle at the winter solstice. I mean, this is where, you know, when you talked about how the haunting, the ghosts and goblins and the idea of haunting at Christmas has come down from pagan times. That's where the tree comes too. And then the Romans adopted the custom of the tree, and they decorated the trees with images of Bacchus during Saturnalia. And in the Germans over in Northern Europe, they decorated trees with candles and apples, and they honored Woden, who was their god. And so I said in my book, when Christianity supplanted these earlier religions and Christmas replaced Saturnalia and the winter solstice celebrations, the ritual of the decorated tree was retained. Only now it symbolized the birth of the Christ child, the embodiment of eternal life. So you go back in kind of a full circle, you know, to this idea of the tree and eternal life. And one of the things I said was that ghosts so many ghost stories, ghosts need to call attention to themselves. You know, if they want to be noticed, they may have a message, and they have to figure out a way to do it. And a Christmas tree is a great way, you know, to get attention. It's literally the center of attention. So if you can mess around with a tree, all eyes are going to be on you. And I found this one story about the Dorrington Hotel, and that's in Calaveras County in California. And they say it's haunted by its former owner, Rebecca Dorrington Gardner. And the hotel's like 155 years old. And Rebecca, like, she likes to turn lights on and off, and she moves furniture. And she rings the hotel's motion detector to alert the staff to danger. But anyway, and ghosts will do that those kinds of things. But apparently she is most famous for knocking down all the guests' Christmas trees. And every guest came and reported, somebody or something knocked my tree down. We had to put them back up. And this mischief continued until they finally took all the trees down. And also there's this Black Horse Inn in Warrington, Virginia. And for, I guess, 3 years in a row, there is some ghost that's tipped over the Christmas tree in the lobby and breaks all the ornaments. And it forces the management to wire the tree to the corner of the room. There's another hotel, the Crescent Hotel in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And they like to move chairs around. They like to move the Christmas tree. And so the staff made sure to lock the room with the Christmas tree in it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they came in the next morning and all these chairs were placed in a semicircle around the tree and nobody ever could figure out who did it. So apparently these ghosts, they like hotel trees. That's one thing. I think that it would be a logical place for ghosts to congregate, you know, at tree.
Sure. And in looking at this book, I mean, I picked out a couple that kind of caught my eye, although there's more than we really have time for. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's obviously 30 tales here. So, that's why folks should pick up on the book. But what are a couple of your favorite stories that you feature in the volume?
You know, I have so many. I'd say one of my big favorites is the story of the fatal Christmas gift of the Bell Witch. And the Bell Witch is probably the most famous documented haunting in America, could be even in the world. But did you know about the Bell Witch when you read the story?
I've heard of it. I've heard of it, but I did not know of it directly. So
yeah,
please share with us.
It's really interesting. There was a movie with Donald Sutherland, mm-hmm, called An American Haunting. I believe it was made in 1992 or 4 or something like that. But anyway, it is the story of the haunting of John Bell and his family in 1817 in Robertson County, Tennessee. And what I can do is I can encapsulate the story, but I'll read you the opening just before the chapter.
Okay.
The story of the Bell Witch is such a famous piece of documented American folklore that it's been the inspiration for numerous books, movies, and even a one-act ballet. Although there have been countless versions of this extraordinary haunting, the basics remain the same. From 1817 to 1821 in Robertson County, Tennessee, a farmer by the name of John Bell and his family were terrorized by a vengeful spirit that made their lives a virtual hell and created such a national sensation that even General Andrew Jackson tried his hand at conquering the demon. But it was 5 days before Christmas 1820 that the witch's antics reached their horrible climax. So John Bell, he was a farmer, very religious man. He had three children, two boys and a daughter that he adored named Betsy. Betsy Bell was 12 years old in 1817 when he was out hunting one day and he saw a really terrible, horrible looking beast that he said it had the body of a dog and the head of a rabbit. And
oh my.
He was a very good marksman, but he didn't get this animal and it disappeared. So he came home and he told the family about it and they were really skeptical. And then he said, well, you know, it's time to read scripture. And he would, every night he would read from the scriptures. And as he was reading from the scriptures, he heard these really, the family heard these strange tapping and scratching sounds. It sounded like there were rodents in the house. And they looked all over for the source of these strange scratching noises, couldn't find anything. And the noises continued. Then they actually, you know, they grew in intensity as the weeks passed. And sometimes it sounded like there was a beast in the house. Then they could hear like snapping and growling. And the family just conducted these exhaustive searches inside, outside the house. They couldn't find anything. And then one night the walls started shaking and the knocking and rapping reached a very, a deafening pitch. By now everybody was really scared. Mm-hmm. And the neighbors came in and, you know, they could hear the noises also. They were witnesses. And there was a man named, Abel Johnson. He was a friend of the family. And he thought the bells were being haunted by an intelligent spirit, as he said, because it ceased its mischief whenever the name of the Lord was invoked. So anyway, however, the spirit got very bold, and eventually it began whispering. They could hear human whispering, and then they heard a voice. And the voice said, I am a spirit from everywhere, heaven, hell, the earth, the air, everywhere. I'm the spirit of your neighbor, old Kate Bates, or Batts. And Kate Batts was really the most unpopular woman in the county. I mean, she was really a literal witch. But she accused John Bell of cheating her. And before she died, she said, I will make his life a hell, and I will put him in his grave, or something to that effect. Wow. And for the next 3 years, that is exactly what this witch did. She would pull everyone's hair at night. She would pull the children out of the bed by their hair.
Wow.
They could hear the cackling. They could hear her. She would sing hymns sometimes, and then she'd sing very evil things. And she would slap. She particularly annoyed Betsy Bell. And this child is the central focus of that movie, An American Haunting. Mm-hmm. Betsy Bell would be lifted from her bed and thrown against the wall. Her hair would be pulled. She would be slapped unconscious. Her face would be red, and they could never see anyone, but they could hear this noise and hear, and this child would be crying and everything. And of course they tried to do an exorcism and that didn't work. And the witch, people came from all over to see her. She's actually listed in one of the Tennessee registries of 1934. The story is listed as being authentic. People began traveling from all over the Tennessee and beyond to go to the bells. You know, it was like the medieval horror or something like that. And Andrew Jackson, before he became president, this was before he was our seventh president, he decided he was going to get that witch. And he came with his men, and the witch apparently stopped his wagon, and the wheels would not move, and then he heard the witch's voice saying, I will see you tonight, and then you may now continue, and then the wagon wheels moved. And Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, you know,
right,
he wasn't going to be put up. But apparently he spent such a sleepless night with his covers being pulled off and his hair being pulled and all of that, that he fled the house. He said, I'd rather fight the whole British Army than the Bell Witch. And he left.
Wow.
And then the Bell Witch had quite a personality. She would be quite charming to some people. There were accounts. I had quoted an account from the period of her wondrous feats. She'd be quite charming to some people and quite awful to other people, and she developed a real affection for John Bell's wife. She would hold John Bell's wife's hands, mm-hmm. and she would give her treats and candies and gifts, and they would fall from the sky, apparently, into her lap. It was just, but at Christmas of 1820, she decided it was time for John Bell to have, you know, his final reckoning. And he came down, he developed facial twitches. He couldn't speak. He couldn't eat. And then he had what looked like a massive stroke. And he was in bed, and he needed his medicine. The doctor had come and prescribed medicine, and the vial was in a it was in, you know, their medicine cabinet at that time.
Right.
His son went to get this vial of medicine and noticed it looked a little strange, and gave it to his dad, and his dad started convulsing. And then the doctor was called in, and he said, "That's not the medicine I prescribed." And they tried it on the cat, and the cat died instantly. And then they heard the Bell Witch cackling.
Wow.
She was very pleased with herself, and she said, "I have given John his dose, and it's done him in." And sure enough, he died at Christmas. And the story went that she just could not, this witch followed them to the funeral. She managed to be silent during the funeral, but the account read that she could not contain her glee at his grave and was singing and wildly and cackling and whatever. So then she hung around, and finally she announced that she was leaving, but she'd be back in 7 years. She did come back in 7 years, and she visited John Bell's older son, predicted the Civil War, among other things. And then she finally left for good. But what I found was interesting, that was Betsy Bell lived to be in her 80s, and to her dying day swore that the whole thing happened. And it was true, and she wrote about it. So did the other Bell children. So, you know, this is one of the most fascinating and horrifying hauntings I've ever heard of, and apparently it reached a climax at this one Christmas, you know.
Well, it certainly seems like a good story to kind of close out our show tonight, and really kind of whet folks' appetite for this new book, Haunted Christmas, Yuletide Ghosts, and Other Spooky Holiday Happenings. And we certainly enjoyed our talk with Mary Beth Crane on the book Haunted Christmas. And you can still find it at Amazon.com, and we'll put a link in the show notes to it. That was certainly an enjoyable conversation. Never forgot that one, even though it's been several years since we did have a chance to catch up with Mary Beth. And do pick up that book. It is super spooky. Now we're going to talk to one of our favorite guests. This is from a couple of years ago, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. We're going to talk about something totally different, Christmas Angels. And here it is. The book is Christmas Angels, True Stories of Hope and Healing. It's out on the Kindle, but it's chock full of inspirational stories about angels in this time of year. And our guest and the author of said book is one of our favorite guests ever on the Paranormal Podcast. She's been on here many times. Most recently, she was on our Other Side podcast to talk about her other angel books. But Christmas Angels is a topic, and the guest is Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She's written over 50 books. She's prolific. She's done books with George Norrie. She's spoken at conferences all over the place. She's been on radio, TV, everywhere you can imagine, and we're so glad to have her back on the show. Rosemary, welcome to the program again, and Merry Christmas.
Hi, Jim, and happy holidays to you, too. It's a pleasure to be back on with you.
Now, you've done numerous books on angels. What inspired you to specifically take a look at Christmas and angels?
Angel experiences happen all year round, but at Christmas time, a lot of attention is focused on angels, and that is simply because of the trappings of the holidays, and people turn to biblical stories and the time of Jesus's birth and how angels heralded that, and how an angel also, the angel Gabriel, came to Mary to announce the coming birth. So people are thinking about angels, and they're prominent in our decorations. I've collected quite a few angel stories over the years about interventions from angels in a timely fashion for big miracles and little miracles where people felt a turning point in their lives. And the ones that have a Christmas theme to them seem particularly poignant. At Christmas time, we're thinking about miracles and about our plans for a better life and reminiscing about the past year. So it seemed like a good idea to pull these together into a book. And I've made it available on Kindle at a very attractive price because I wanted it to be a Christmas present from me as well. And something that people could easily pick up for the holidays or year round. Actually, people are dipping into that book all year long.
Yeah. And the interesting thing to me is this. I mean, to me, the holiday season is fraught with emotion. And, you know, in terms of kind of like the storybook and what we see on TV and so forth, it's always happy, happy, happy. But sometimes the holidays can be a very trying time. And maybe for people who are ill or people who have a loss in the family or people who are alone, it in some ways can be the most difficult time of the year. And I think that it's a time where maybe a little special intervention is needed more than ever.
You're absolutely right, Jim. Even when the holidays are happy, there's still a lot of stresses. I have quite a variety of stories in the book, and some of them do concern people who are dealing with grief over the loss of loved ones and how some sort of angelic intervention or miracle made a big difference for them, enabled them to turn a corner in the holidays, to hold on, to put things into a better context. I have stories of rescue, angels coming to the rescue when people are in a jam, angels appearing at moments where healing is needed. People have been in accidents or trying circumstances, and they have marked experiences of angels around them that they feel made the difference between healing and not healing.
Now, a little bit of this will be repeat from our other side podcast, but I think it's important to talk about a little bit. When we see angels in books, in movies, on television, you know, you've got the prototypical halo and the wings and so forth. In your experience, how do angels manifest themselves?
Most of the time, people feel angels around them. They sense a presence that they intuitively know is a divine messenger, something that has tremendous power to make a difference, to heal, to help. Sometimes people visually see angels, and most of the time it's as a pillar of light. It probably is not going to have a human form, but people instinctively know that this pillar of light is an angel. I do have a story in the book concerning a woman who had suffered an accident, and she prayed to St. Luke for help, and she feels that St. Luke sent an angel to assist her. And when she saw this being, she saw a form that had wings. And that's the traditional way we think of angels.
Well, it is certainly a very poignant, as you said, and very touching subject. We're going to talk about it more on this special edition of the Paranormal Podcast right after this.
Want to help Jim out? Share a show with your friends on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. It's free, and he'll sure appreciate it. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold. It is a special edition. It's a holiday edition, and the subject today is Christmas Angels, True Stories of Hope and Healing. It is a book by Rosemary Ellen Guiley, available on the Amazon Kindle store, and a great bargain and a kind of electronic stocking stuffer for yourself or a loved one this time of year. Rosemary, we certainly don't want to give away all the stories, because really to get the full flavor of them, you have to read the book. However, I would like you maybe to share a story that was particularly meaningful or powerful to you in the book that kind of represents what this book is all about.
One of the most powerful stories for me concerns a young woman named Kelly, and it's a very good example of the mysterious stranger intervention. These are cases where people find themselves in some sort of turmoil or even a crisis, and a mysterious stranger who seems to them to be a real person intervenes, turns everything around, and then disappears. And they realize later they've been dealing with an angel. Well, this young woman had come from a very traumatic childhood, a lot of domestic problems. She had, as a child, witnessed her mother attempt to commit suicide. Later on, her parents went through a divorce, and while the divorce was in progress, her father committed suicide. And she, like many children in similar circumstances, blamed herself for his death and for all of these difficulties. As she got to be a little older and on her own, she got into alcohol and drugs, and her life literally, as she told me, went swirling down the drain. Well, one year, very close to Christmas, she went out drinking with some friends of hers, and she got up to go get some drinks from the table. Her friend said, "Hey, why don't you go to the bar and get us some drinks?" They've been there quite a while. She goes up to the bar, and there she meets a man who was a big, imposing black man with penetrating eyes, just brilliant eyes. And he was sitting at the bar with a full glass of beer, and he looked at her and he said, "You don't need to do this, you know." And she felt like she immediately knew him. And why was he seeming to know what was going on inside of her? She engaged in a conversation with him for what felt like a very long time. And he told her things about herself that he couldn't, as a stranger, have possibly known. And the upshot of it was he turned her thinking around. And she went back to the table without any drinks for her friends. And they said, "Hey, you know, what about our drinks?" And she said, "Well, I was talking to that fellow there at the bar." And she turned around to point to where the man had been sitting, and he was gone. The only thing sitting at the bar was his still full glass of beer. And the upshot of it was that she was so inspired by this conversation and by the spiritual power she felt from this, now what she knew was an angel, that she got into AA, she got herself clean, straight, and sober. She really turned her life around. And angels can come at crucial times like that. She was ready for change, and you have to be ready for change. You know, nothing can force us to change. You have to be ready for it. But the angel came at a crucial time when she was really ready to get her life back together. And she credits that angelic intervention with the most powerful turning point in her life.
And do you find that these experiences, whether they're Christmas experiences or not, do they change the person in a way for the long term?
They often do, Jim. At the very least, people give pause for thought about divine intervention and calling upon the divine and angelic beings for help in times of need. Sometimes the angels have responded just to a simple prayer for help. And other times people haven't consciously prayed, but they're in a jam and they want, you know, they're in need of some kind of help. And what answers is an angel. So it often causes people to rethink their spirituality, rethink the help that's available from the divine if you call upon it. And that's what angels tell us, that they're ready to help, but we have to call on them. They are God's messengers. They are God's intercessors. They're not going to do things for us. They're not going to solve all of our problems for us. They're going to help us at critical times to make the right choices. And that's a very important distinction to make.
Something that I find interesting is that story you told about the angel in the bar. These angels go out into the world. It's not something reserved for a church. They find people where they're at and help them in need in whatever situation they're at. Is that correct?
That is correct. Anyone and everyone can receive help from angels. And that is one of their divine purposes, to act out the will of God and to act out God's plan for wholeness, harmony, and healing. This help can be accessed through prayer, through meditation, and also just simply being aware that angels are real, they do exist. And no matter what faith you have, there are beings who have that calling, whether they're called angels or spirit messengers or guardians, many names for them in different mythologies, but they all serve the same function, connecting us to the divine and to tremendous sources of strength, healing, and problem solving.
Do angels ever affect something that almost seems impossible, like a miracle, a physical impossibility. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Well, certainly in cases of healing, yes. There have been cases of miraculous healing where people have felt themselves in the presence of angels and religious figures. Sometimes these come through dreams where people have been desperately ill with conditions diagnosed as either chronic or terminal, and they've had a miraculous turnaround after being visited by a divine messenger. Many cases like that in the literature on what the medical profession would call unexplained spontaneous healing.
When it comes to angels, do they tend to, you talked about the gentleman in the bar, or the angel in the bar, sorry. Do they tend to speak, or do they tend to be silent? Or is it more common for them to interact, or is it usually kind of like a mental telepathy?
It really depends on the situation. In cases of the intervention of the mysterious stranger, the majority of cases involve these helpful people, what seem to be real people, who come, who suddenly show up. They know exactly what the problem is, what needs to be done to solve it, and they don't talk very much. In fact, that's one of the standouts about them. In the case of Kelly, who met the angelic messenger in the bar, that was different. And it involved a conversation which may have taken part on a mental telepathy level as well as a conversational level. But the standout characteristics are that there's something unusual about these people. And most mysterious strangers are male. They're male rather than female. They can be both, but most of them are male. Mm-hmm. There's something very distinctive about them, usually the eyes. The eyes are brilliant and shiny. If they're blue, they're a very intense blue, uncharacteristic of what you would see in most human beings. These people radiate some sort of energy, and they're very efficient. They show up suddenly, they resolve an issue, and then they disappear. And in cases where people have tried to track them down to ask, who was that person and where can I find them to thank them, they find no evidence of any such person.
So it's almost kind of like a Twilight Zone experience. That's what I think of when I hear of this. It's that strange and that supernatural in many cases.
I believe that a lot of these experiences actually take place in a liminal dimension, that we're neither entirely in the physical or entirely somewhere else. We're sort of between. And that's where we can have these encounters. Oftentimes people describe that the surroundings around them sort of fade into the background. You're so intensely focused with this angelic being. And that was certainly the case for Kelly in the bar, where the surroundings around her seemed to recede far, far into the background, and she completely lost track of time. So it seems that we're catapulted into this arena where we can have this meaningful encounter. Similarly, dreams that have encounters with otherworldly beings are somewhat the same. That is, people feel they're having a real experience, but they know it isn't quite anything in the physical plane.
Now, angels are certainly discussed. I mean, there's been a ton of popular entertainment done on them. Heaven Can Wait, various versions of that picture, and the old Michael Landon show, and a lot of things have been done. But you really, especially these days, you hear so much about ghosts. Everything is ghosts. But it seems like there's a strong recorded history of angels. Why do we not hear as much about angels as we do something like ghosts, or something maybe possibly more malevolent? Why is it just that, good news doesn't get reported? What do you think's behind that?
Things go in cycles and trends. And when I first started researching angels in the early 1990s, they were just coming into vogue, so to speak, as topics for the popular media. And a number of authors who had researched the phenomenon even before the 90s had commented in their own works that it was difficult to get people to talk about their angel experiences. People had them, but they seemed to be under this impression that it was some sort of hubris to think that you had had a visit from a divine messenger, that you might be crazy or imagining things, or other people would laugh at you to say you had been visited by an angel. So I think a lot of people kept their experiences under wraps. And then we got into conditions where it was okay to talk about them. The media made it okay. And people were open about it, and that encouraged more people to talk about it. So during the 90s, we had quite a rush of angel stories that probably were there all along. Well, in the 2000s, the emphasis in the media swung to ghosts. And some of it is the case of, you know, the popular media just looking for new topics to tackle. Mm-hmm. But the popularity of angels has never really gone away. I've done 6 books on angels, and I continue to receive a lot of emails from people who want to share their experiences with me or ask questions about angels. And I'm seeing now, as we're heading into the, thankfully, the post-2012 point pretty soon, that people are once again turning to the intervention of the divine in the affairs of human beings.
Something that I wonder about is how have angels helped people with grief? Because I think that's a particularly sensitive issue this time of year, when someone maybe is going through the first Christmas season after a loss of somebody, or maybe in past years, and I know this has happened in my family, where a loved one has died in the holidays, and it's always a constant reminder every year. You bring out the Christmas ornaments, and you also bring out the memories of the person who passed around Christmas. So it can be a tough time of year. How have angels helped people soothe grief?
They do so in a number of ways, and one is profound comfort, that even in the midst of our darkest days and our greatest losses, we have a divine comfort and support that we will be okay. Angels also help us to forge a bridge to our lost loved ones. They help strengthen our belief in the afterlife, in the presence, the ongoing presence of someone in one's life. They can provide synchronicities and signs connected to a departed loved one. The appearance of something in nature. Sometimes it's lights going on and off. A song coming over the radio at just the right time. And all of these things get rolled into a grief processing that bolsters a person's ability to shoulder the load.
I think it would be a nice touch, maybe as we close this discussion of angels, Christmas angels specifically, if you could tell us a brief story of a particularly Christmassy angel occurrence that you document.
Well, let's see. There was one case I had involving the death of a young man in college, and some of the stories involve people who die progressively. It's a cancer, and so people have time to prepare for it. It's very heartbreaking for parents to have to take a child through that. But in one of the stories, when a young man passes away and it's Christmas time, he and his surviving family members feel his presence very strongly and experience a play of lights, as though he's giving them a sign that, you know, from the afterlife he's looking on, he's still connected to them, the bond of love is still there. And people interpret these signs in very profound ways. They're very comforting. And so even in the midst of grief at Christmas time, it's like a Christmas gift. It's a Christmas gift from beyond. I had an experience myself, not involving loss through life, but it was some years ago after I went through a divorce, and at Christmas time I was feeling very lonely and sad, and you know, tumultuous time when you're on your own like that after a traumatic breakup. And I had an experience where the lights, I put up a Christmas tree and I would plug the lights in and unplug the lights, you know, I went to bed. And sure. One morning I came downstairs and the Christmas tree was unplugged, but it lit up for, you know, just a flash of a moment. And with that came an inner voice that said, you know, that I was going to be all right, that I was not alone. I would be all right. And I just had to ask myself, you know, did I imagine this? Was it a projection? Was it wishful thinking? Or did I really experience it? Well, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I saw the lights flash on and off. What matters is what you do with the experience. And in just that brief moment, even though I was by myself, I felt very comforted. And, you know, you turn your thoughts to the positive. You think, well, here are all the things that I have to be thankful for. So I should acknowledge my losses and you know, honor them. But at the same time, we have to put our emphasis into the positive so we can keep moving forward. And that's what these experiences really excel at helping people with.
And it's interesting. I've had an experience that I've told on the programs before. I won't belabor it, with my brother, and hearing a particular artist on the radio who you never hear on the radio, right after his death, as I was driving back from his funeral. And I took that as a sign. And I think your point that to some extent it doesn't really matter. It comforted me. I think there's some validity in that. I happen to think that there was something to it because I never heard that person on general radio, I think, before or after. But, and it was an artist that had specific significance to him. So I think it was him, but if it wasn't, it still helped a whole heck of a lot.
It does. And I tell people, and I believe this myself, the universe is a magical place and it orders itself for each and every person. We get the signs that we need at the moment we need them. And if you live your life in a magical place like that, you are constantly reinforced by the divine, in terms of everything going on in your life, the positive, the difficult, the traumatic, everything.
Well, Rosemary, obviously people can go to Amazon to pick up this Kindle book, Christmas Angels, a fantastic stocking stuffer, electronically for yourself or someone else who would enjoy the subject matter. I know you've put a lot of books out on Kindle regularly, and a number of your other angel books are out on the Kindle as well, correct?
Ask the Angels is out on Kindle. I believe the Encyclopedia of Angels is out on Kindle as well. I do have some of my books that have been out of print now for a while that I will be getting up on Kindle in the next year or so.
Yeah, that is excellent. And where can folks go to keep up with everything you're doing? I know you have a central website, a hub for everything, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and you're always doing such interesting stuff. So we like to keep up to date on that. Where can folks go to find all of that?
VisionaryLiving.com is my website. And I do have a monthly e-newsletter called Strange Dimensions, which is complimentary. And it includes my calendar and also a lot of articles of interest in all the things I do in the paranormal and metaphysical fields. I answer questions from readers as well. And I do recommend that people join that mailing list if they would like to keep up with everything that goes on in my strange and enchanting world.
Well, I'm going to have to do that. I am definitely going to have to do that, and I suggest that everybody else does it well. Well, Rosemary, have a fabulous holiday season. Thank you for sharing these inspirational tales of Christmas angels, and we hope everybody will pick up on the book.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that mega holiday special on the Paranormal Podcast. I know that I did. And again, Thank you for all you've done for us in the last year and really for the last 11 years. And we're looking forward to a big 2017. Now, next week, we'll have Maria DeSimone on for our year-end astrology show. So stay tuned for that and have a happy and healthy holiday, whether it be Christmas or the winter holiday of your choice. We thank you so much. And we'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Bye-bye, everybody. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com and thanks for listening.